Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 14 for August 12th, 2009. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting, and this week my podcasting partner is Dr. Ed Brenniger from the Leading Questions blog. Ed, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, Peter.
Good. Ed, you're a new co-host with us here, filling in for Pam while she's got some other conflicts. I think it would be great for you to introduce yourself and talk a little bit about what you do, who you are, and what you do.
Thank you, Peter. I am a consultant of various types. I do a lot of leadership development consulting and organizational development consulting, and I work with leaders on how they manage change and go through the process of going from one stage of their development as leaders and as for their companies and businesses to reach another level. So it's a variety of things, very personal, but very organizationally oriented as well. I write for you and your weekly leader site, the leadership Q&A column, and we're adding into that the work-life lead column, which will alternate. And I live in North Carolina and have been doing this kind of work for almost 15 years.
Well, how'd you get into this?
I began my career as a Presbyterian minister, and I was doing community work in Atlanta. And my neighborhood that I was in downtown in Atlanta, there was a business association, and I ended up being the clergy representative to this business association. And I found them to be a tremendously innovative group of people. And they gave me the sense of the potential that community leaders could have. And from that point on, I began to look at what leadership was, and eventually ended up in a collegiate setting where I was running a student leaders program. And then 14 plus years ago, I started a consulting business doing leadership development. So it's been about a 25-year long process of getting me to where I am today.
Great. And I've been a big fan of your Leading Questions blog for a while. When did you start that endeavor?
The first blog post was on July 4th of 2004. So it's been over 5 years now.
Wow.
And yeah. It's been fun. I've learned a lot from it and enjoy the interaction with people that has come from that.
Yeah, I always enjoy it. What's the URL?
It is http://edbrenniger.typepad.com.
Great. We'll have that in the show notes as well. So okay. Speaking of blogs, we decided a couple weeks ago, and actually we did this on the blog earlier, that each week we were going to have a weekly leader blog of the week, and this week we identified Steve Rosler's All Things Workplace. The byline on that blog, by the way, is Teaching Smart People Practical Ways to Become Extraordinary, which I think is great. One of the reasons we chose it was you might be familiar with Kevin Eikenberry's remarkable leadership, and he actually each year for I think 3 years or so maybe ran a poll for best leadership blogs, and Steve Rosler's All Things Workplace won. And so congratulations to him. Are you familiar with that one?
Yes, I am. I got to know Steve a couple of years ago through an association with a fellow named Galba Bright, who's passed away past year, who had a site focused on emotional intelligence. He worked out of Jamaica, and Steve and I got to know one another through Galba, and last year he won this leadership blog of the year thing, and he's won it again this year. He's got a great blog. It is very practical. He's a great guy and has really great information, and I recommend him highly to people.
Yeah, it's good. It's a fairly simple layout of the blog. He's got relatively short posts in there, full of useful insights, and pretty, you know, whittles it down to some pretty simple ideas. So definitely want to point people in that direction. Check it out. It's definitely worth a read, and get it in your reader. So you write, as you mentioned before, you write a column for us. Well, you write two, actually. You started out Leadership Q&A, which is a question and answer, obviously. And then recently you've been working on Work-Life Lead. You want to talk a little bit about both those?
Sure. The leadership Q&A is an outgrowth of a column that I wrote for the Asheville Citizen Times for almost 5 years called Real Life Leadership. And I ceased to write that back in the winter and, you know, found myself writing for you a leadership Q&A blog. And really the purpose of that is to answer questions that people have and to answer questions in as practical a way as possible. And some of the questions I interpret from what I'm hearing people, the stories they're telling and the issues they're addressing. Some of them come straight out of my client work. Some of them come out of just the networking I do. And I'm just listening to what people are saying and trying to understand what questions they have and trying to address them there. Over the past 6 weeks, the issue of work and life and that intersection between our personal lives and our professional lives has become more prominent. It wasn't really prominent for me, but it became prominent for the people that I was dealing with, the clients I was dealing with. And I began to realize that there was a need for some more focused thought about the intersection between work and life. And so I decided I would start writing about this and use your weekly leader site as a way to do that. So my plan is to alternate weeks, leadership Q&A 1 week, work-life lead the following week. And today I'll be posting one work-life lead on communication, the importance of communication, what that really is in the workplace, but also as we do it in our homes and how they're actually quite similar. And just to kind of give you a preview, just kind of using not so much an acronym, but an alliteration of three C's of that our communication needs to be clear, it needs to be conversational, and it needs to be coherent or something that leads to consequences that we are quite aware of. So if we're communicating with people, we actually want them to do something with what we're sharing with them so that it has a practical and action-oriented application.
Great. Look forward to that as everything. Great contributions. One thing I really enjoy about particularly leadership Q&A is how you use Twitter to get the questions out there and get people engaged in the conversation.
Yeah, I haven't had much time lately to do Twitter, but yeah, that's been interesting. And actually some of the information that I've gotten from people that helped me understand what to say has come through some of the social media things other than Twitter, some of the social network sites. And in one case, I posted a question about morale to one of these sites, and within about 10 days had over 130 responses that were quite substantial, to the point where we're going to turn that into a free ebook that we'll be distributing soon. So the next couple of weeks, hopefully, we'll be posting that at Weekly Leader as something that people can download and find some benefit from.
Excellent. Well, you and I had a fantastic opportunity a couple weeks ago to talk to Marty Linsky. And Marty is a co-author of a new book called The Practice of Adaptive Leadership. The other author, or there are two authors on that. Ron Heifetz is his partner at a firm called Cambridge Leadership Associates. He's one of the other authors in the book. And Alexander Grashaw is the third author of the book. And Marty spent 45 minutes talking to you and me on the book and leadership, so let's give it a listen. This week I'm fortunate to have my colleague, Dr. Ed Brenniger, a contributor to Weekly Leader, join me in interviewing our Weekly Leader this week. That is Marty Linsky, who recently co-authored a new book called The Practice of Adaptive Leadership. Marty, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here with you.
Marty, for our Weekly Leader listeners, could you give us a little background of who you are and what you do?
Well, I've been on the faculty of the Kennedy School at Harvard since 1979, but I'm the co-founder and principal of a leadership development firm called Cambridge Leadership Associates. And most of my time and psychic energy is devoted to the firm. We're a global firm, and we work with organizations across all three sectors, the public, private, and nonprofit, and all over the world. We have active clients in Asia and South America, Europe, North America. So I spend a lot of time on airplanes, for better or for worse. Good for frequent flyers, not so good for everything else.
I bet you do. You also have written a few, well, you've written, I know Leadership on the Line is another book you co-authored with Ron Heifetz.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Heifetz and I wrote Leadership on the Line. He had written what is really thought of as a seminal book called Leadership Without Easy Answers, and that was published quite a while ago in the early 1990s. And we had long talked about that was a pretty theoretical book, and we had long talked about trying to make these ideas more accessible to people. And Leadership on the Line, which was published by Harvard Business Press in 2002, was the product of that work. And it's been a very successful book, and I think has brought these ideas to a pretty wide audience. The Practice of Adaptive Leadership, the book that we published, Harvard Business Press published this spring, is a very practical book. It's really tools and techniques and frameworks. It's written for anybody who wants to exercise leadership, trying to give people the kind of resources that will enable them to do more on behalf of what they care about the most.
If you were to tell us your definition of adaptive leadership, actually, I'm looking for two definitions. First of all, how would you explain this to my mother, who's never worked in, but really was a mom who stayed at home and took care of me and never had a business career? First of all, how would you explain something, adaptive leadership, to somebody like her? And then second of all, how would you explain it to a CEO who you might be working on a potential engagement with?
Well, in many ways, the explanations wouldn't be all that different. We think of leadership as an activity, not a person. And so we talk a lot about behaviors. Well, what does exercising leadership look like? We don't talk about leaders at all. We talk about people who want to exercise leadership more often than they have in the past on behalf of what they care about. And so if I were talking to your mom or talking to a CEO, I'd want to hear what is the gap between what they aspire and what they aspire to accomplish and what they aspire for changing their piece of the world and the current reality. And then we'd begin to talk about what causes that gap. How do we understand that gap? We think that identifying that gap and then beginning to think about how you can close that gap is the way to approach problems. But leadership, we roll that back and start from a couple of very core ideas about what makes leadership difficult and what makes leadership dangerous. From our perspective, people don't exercise leadership enough in the world. And so we began Leadership on the Line was really an inquiry to try to understand better than we had in the past why people don't exercise leadership more often than they do. And what we came away from that experience believing is that leadership is difficult and dangerous work. That's why people don't do it more often than they do, and that's why there's such a yearning for leadership, is that people realize that it is difficult and dangerous work. And so we begin to help people think about what makes leadership difficult and dangerous and how they can use those insights into making progress on whatever it is they want to make progress on.
It's an interesting process. Three authors collaborating on a book would seem to almost present an adaptive challenge in and of itself. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and actually for your motivation in writing the book? You've told us about that really, but what do you readers expect to get out of it?
Well, it was an adaptive challenge, but Ronnie and I kid a lot about the fact that if I was writing Leadership on the Line alone, it would have been out 2 years before and would have been a piece of junk. And if he was writing it all alone, he'd still be working on it. So it was an exciting and rewarding process. It was not the first collaboration I had ever done, but like a lot of stories that I've heard, the first book I collaborated with somebody on ruined the friendship. And so we were very careful. He and I are probably each other's closest professional colleagues and quite close personal friends. And we were concerned about that, and I think it was a huge challenge to be collaborative, to have lots of difficult conversations, to figure out what was really important to each of us, and to honor that, and to acknowledge that each one of us was going to have to make some compromises in order to have a successful product. It was even more complicated with three people. I don't know if you, Ed and Peter, if you have kids, but, you know, yeah. My experience is two is three times one, and three is five times two for kids. And three of us was very complicated, but we ended up dovetailing pretty well because each of us have different set of skills. And Heifetz and I own Cambridge Leadership Associates, and Alexander Grasho, our third author, is the managing director. So it was we felt this was a book that was really, in some ways, written by our clients and students. It was a product of the work that we've done in both the classroom and in our consulting work, really over the last 25 years. All the techniques, all the tools, all the ideas in the book have been road tested in real life situations. And like Leadership on the Line, the practice of adaptive leadership is full of examples, real life, not glorious examples, although they're more heroic examples in Leadership on the Line, but real life examples from people in organizational life who were trying to make a difference in the world.
Yeah, I love the stories in it. I love the successes as well as some of the failures you go over in the book. I think they're very valuable for the reader.
You know, we in Leadership on the Line, we really tried to figure out why people trying to do the right thing get in so much trouble. And so it was a book more about learning from failures than learning from successes. And some of that is true in the practice of adaptive leadership as well.
Marty, I loved your book. I love all three of your books, or the ones that Ron has contributed to. And I first heard Ron speak before Leadership Without Easy Answers came out, and have been a fan of his for a long time, and think he's one of the real geniuses in the leadership world. I guess that you feel that way too. And
I agree with that. Yeah.
How fortunate it is to be a partner with him. My question has to do with kind of the current reality that a lot of businesses are facing. Some of the people that I know, are their companies are really on the edge of survival. The question is, how are we going to survive? What do we need to do? How do we align our revenue with expenses? And what does that mean for our staffing? And how do we help our people to do more with less? And how do we deal with issues of fear of job loss and issues of morale and that sort of thing? And so much of the adaptive leadership model is challenging old ways of doing things. So how does, when you're in a crisis mode of survival, how does the adaptive leader function in that respect?
Well, we've been working with a lot of organizations, as you can imagine, during this period of time, and trying to think about and help them think about these issues. Without being too glib about it, we start from the proposition that the turbulent times we're in present an opportunity rather than just a problem. And we have been spending a lot of time with organizations trying to help them take advantage of the turmoil and take advantage of the uncertainty that we're in by raising and addressing issues that they couldn't get traction on in calmer times when people are heavily invested in the status quo. People fantasize, I think, that life is going to somehow return to the status quo ante. We don't believe that. But even if you do believe that and hope that, you have to be open to the possibility that that's just not going to be the case. And what that means is that you need to begin to think what we think about as resetting. You need to begin to think about what are the things that we can do now to prepare us for the future and for an uncertain future. So, for example, we have worked with some organizations on the commitment to retain their best people during these difficult times. because you need your best people in place, not only to do more with less, but also to help you invent the future. Because one of the opportunities now, with so much uncertainty out there, is that people who are willing to try to invent the future are going to be the ones who do it. So we're trying to work with firms and encourage them to take that kind of posture. It's very challenging because, as you say, there's so much panic out there now that people are people's first reaction is just about survival. But we really believe that there are enormous opportunities for organizations across all three sectors to do things now that they couldn't possibly do in calmer times.
I totally agree with you, and it's an exciting time. As hard as it is an exciting time for that reason. I totally agree with you, and I see that one of the conceptual hurdles that leaders or the leaders of businesses have to,
we would call them people trying to exercise leadership.
I
don't want to be
That's
too
fine.
Cute about this, but it's so important that people, to us, that people think of leadership as an opportunity that comes before anyone, no matter where you sit in the organization. One of my favorite organizations that is the Los Angeles, the county, the sheriff of Los Angeles County, a guy named Lee Baca, incredibly innovative guy. He has thousands of employees, and every single employee on his first or her first day of employment signs a piece of paper saying that they recognize their responsibility for leadership in the organization. And we think that's a critical state of mind in organizational life. So anyway, excuse me for the semantic.
Thank you for challenging my my terminology. Okay, the people who are in positions that have traditionally been thought of as leaders.
Yes, senior authorities.
The question that I have is, what's your suggestion to them as they're listening into today for developing that leadership capacity in their people? And I'm thinking of not just their managers or their vice presidents, but all the way through the entire organization, and particularly how you do that with a large, complex, global organization. How does that happen?
Well, we're working with a global actuarial firm now. We've been working with them for several years. And that was the challenge that they presented to us. We spent the first probably 6 months of our engagement with them working with their top team, because we felt, although this was a hard pill for them to swallow, that the way they worked together or didn't work together, the way they communicated with each other or didn't communicate with each other, was going to be the single most important factor, variable, in determining whether they could cascade a leadership culture throughout the organization. So we spent a lot of time working with their top team. But then we spent time developing what we call a leadership culture in the organization. So here are some of the kinds of first of all, we think it's really important to have a shared language. That is, that people are using the same terms to talk about problems. As you know, we make a big distinction between technical problems and adaptive challenges. Mm-hmm. And we find that language, and the language about getting on the balcony, and the language about the distinction between leadership and authority, we don't hold any, there's nothing magic about that language, but it as a shared language, it helps people think about problems together. That's the first thing. Second thing is we try to develop a culture of peer consulting, which is very, very, very challenging. But from our point of view, what creates a leadership culture is people spending more time with their organizational hat on their heads than with their turf hat. And so we spend a lot of time working with organizations to help people think of themselves as having a responsibility for the organization as a whole rather than their own piece of the action. And part of that is, in one of the ways we do that is trying to create peer consulting, so people actually talk to each other about their problems. So if the three of us, you and Ed and Peter and I, were working in the same organization, and Peter had a problem in his division, our response, Ed, would be not, gee, it's tough to be Peter, but we've got a problem too. And we need to figure out how we can work with Peter to address that issue. So that's a second element that we try very hard to work on, is to create this sense of shared responsibility, which we think is a critical piece of developing a leadership culture. The third is a culture around risk-taking and innovation. We've run into a lot of senior authorities, CEOs and the like, whose message to their organization is, we want you to be innovative and risk-taking, but if you screw up once, you're out of here. And, of course, they don't say that, but that's the behavior. And so we work with senior authorities and organizations to protect innovation and risk-taking and creativity. And what that means, you only know whether it's protected, mistake made, and it is treated as a learning opportunity rather than as a problem. I loved, just to take an obvious contemporary example, I loved it when the president said, this is a teachable moment, talking about the Gates thing, because it seemed to me that's exactly the right attitude, is to think of the incident that happened in Cambridge as an opportunity for learning rather than a screw-up and who are we going to blame, right? Which is often the response in organizational life. Okay, whose fault it is? Whose head is going to get chopped off here? And from our point of view, what that does, it not only doesn't do much about the initial problem, but it deeply undermines a culture of innovation and risk-taking.
Let me ask you this. If you try to create a way to protect those who are risk takers and innovators, how do you create a system of compensation and rewards in that environment? What are you going to do in that, with that aspect of...
Well, we know a couple of organizations that give out awards for the biggest failed experiment from which important stuff was learned. You can actually reward innovation even when it doesn't succeed. You can reward risk-taking. Now, going back to the second point, we often talk with organizations about how much of their reward system is based on the behaviors they say they're trying to nurture and how much is based on different set of behaviors. And so, for example, how much of people's compensation is based on how well the organization as a whole does and how much of it is based on how their own turf does becomes a very critical factor. Very often what we see in organizations is that there is lip service paid to a set of values, but on the ground those values look like they are honored in the breach as much as they are in the observance.
Marty, in your work, is there a typical profile or set of characteristics that manifest themselves with people who successfully exercise adaptive leadership and conversely, who don't, who aren't successful in trying to use this model?
We don't think that anybody exercises leadership 24/7. So we look for particular individuals. I mean, I'm thinking now of Jeff Immelt, who's the CEO of GE. And he did an extraordinary thing 6 months ago. He cut the GE dividend, which had not been cut since the 1930s. It was part of their, deeply invested in their culture, part of their promotion, part of their message to shareholders. And he cut the dividend, and the stock price tanked the next day.
Right.
And he wrote a $50,000 personal check to buy some stock that day. And that was a powerful message. But that's just a technique. It's a tool. I mean, it's not who he is as a human being, but he saw that there was this opportunity or this requirement for him to step up and say to people, I believe in this company. And sure, this was really, really hard, and I know it's how hard it is, but I believe in this company, and I'm going to not just say I believe in this company, but I'm going to show you that I believe in this company. And I think that's all the difference in the world. And to me, that's what separates the people who exercise leadership from the people who talk about it but operate in very different ways.
So, Ed, that was Marty's take on the Practice of Adaptive Leadership, Part 1, and I really enjoyed spending time with him. I could listen or talk with him all day long. What'd you think?
Me too. I really like his book. I really like Ron Heifetz's thinking about leadership. I heard him almost 20 years ago and before his original book of Leadership Without Easy Answers came out, and you know, sort of was a preview of 2 or 3 years before that came out. And I think it's great stuff. And the part that I really like about it more than anything is their emphasis upon everyone being able to behave as a leader. And I really believe in that. And I think it's a very important thing to communicate to people throughout organizations. And, you know, that's typically not the case. I find that people don't like to be called a leader because it assumes some role within the organization that they don't feel comfortable taking on. But if you were to, but I found that when you describe to them what the behaviors and attitudes of leadership are, that they're willing to accept that and take that on. So yeah, I think it's a very important aspect of their thinking that needs a wider conversation.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. He came right out at the top of the interview and talking about how he feels leadership is not exercised enough, and that an important part of what they do at Cambridge Leadership Associates is making sure that people understand that leadership can be exercised at all levels throughout the organization. It's an activity and not necessarily a role. Yeah, I think as you identified, not enough people in corporations or organizations think that way, unfortunately. I thought also I really enjoyed something we've talked about a number of times on the podcast previously is what he came out with here also is crisis presents an opportunity. And he felt that the people that actually take advantage of the crisis and do not assume that things will I think he said actually people fantasize that that crisis will return to a status quo, this crisis situation will return to a status quo, and it doesn't. But the people who try to invent the future are the ones that actually do it. I think that's also very powerful, and that's really what leadership is fundamentally all about. So, you know, he feels that people that take advantage of these opportunities to exercise leadership are the leaders, and that leadership is an activity more than a role or a title. And it actually goes to great lengths to separate the concept of leadership from authority. And jumping into that point, he identified three different points about adaptive leadership that they try to use when they come to an organization with their work. And those three points are it's very important to have a shared language. And I think part of that shared language is the fact that you exercise leadership, that they separate leadership from authority. They use this term of getting on the balcony so that you can kind of separate yourself from the actual activity, even though you are part of that activity, to serve two different roles. So they, you know, create a framework, a shared language, so everybody's on the same page. The second point he mentioned was creating a culture of peer consulting where you really create a sense of shared responsibility. So I think he said, you know, we're working together. You, me, and him are working together, and I have a problem. Well, it's not my problem. It's we have a problem.
Yeah.
And it's very important to create that that mindset within an organization. The final point he brought out was creating a culture of risk-taking and innovation and protecting that, you know, spending some effort and time to protect that. And I know you asked him about how you compensate people for doing that. You know, he remarked that his experiences were that some companies actually reward some of their biggest failures from which important lessons or very important lessons are learned. So what other thoughts did you have?
Well, I if we were continuing the conversation with that, maybe challenge him a little bit on the authority issue of roles and whether you could use the word leadership as a way of describing a role. And I don't think it's quite as simple as, well, leaders are just people who behave a certain way. I think that is certainly true, but I think there's also a way of defining a role within a company. And I think what we did was that there was a kind of an awkward way of talking about people who used to be called leaders, you know, and that becomes an awkward way of talking about it. So if you're not a leader, what is it that you are? And the role of issue of titles is is important. That's part of the shared language, I think. So I think in a sense what they've created is a culture or an atmosphere or an environment where this conversation can go on. I don't think it's a final verdict on leadership in any way. And I think it's important. I think the hard part is for people who are in authority to be willing to release that authority to others, so that people who are in the lower levels of a business have a sense of ownership of, say, issue resolution or solving problems. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that leaders have, that people in authority have, which is to relinquish control.
I think, you know, all of us who have working in the leadership development field would wrestle with this concept of, you know, especially when we try to communicate and articulate our thoughts and I'm a firm believer of their theories about leadership in that it's an exercise and an activity rather than a role. But when you write about it, or when you try to talk about it or communicate about it, it's so easy to default to the word leader. And, you know, frankly, I kind of feel that's part of the trouble with it. And I think that what they'd argue with you in separating the idea of leadership from authority is that, okay, we may have a person in a position like a CEO or a governor or, you know, any kind of significant position, executive director in a nonprofit. They may have a title, but they may not be exercising actual leadership.
Right.
And, you know, they spend a lot of time with this when you attend the Art and Practice of Leadership Development. And I can always remember Ron Heifetz spending some time talking about how it's kind of our human nature to look to these people in these roles, these authority positions, to solve our problems for us. And they can't, you know, especially the adaptive ones. The technical ones where they can pull a few strings and delegate to somebody to get something done or do something, that's one thing. But when we have these big adaptive challenges, they can't solve those. So they're in a bit of a catch-22 in that we look to them to solve them. They can't solve them, and then they become scapegoats for – you know, we make them our scapegoats when the problems don't go away. The economy doesn't fix itself, or the, you know, child obesity doesn't become, abated. So I think they'd argue with you that there is a distinct difference between having that authority, that title, and actually being engaged in leadership, which is a process and exercise and moving, creating change.
And I would agree with them, and I wouldn't argue that case. I think the issue for me is that we're living in a paradoxical situation where we have hierarchical structures for organizations, and we're stressing a greater and greater relationship and community and interaction, which really is the opposite of that hierarchy. And we really have to find a way to keep both of those in kind of a dramatic tension. And that's what I see in this whole issue of terminology and behaviors. And I'm not sure that there is any way of around that other than to continue to pose the question and to work that out and to find ways for groups within, you know, large vertically integrated organizational structures to find ways to make their relationships matter. I look at, say, Robert Greenleaf's servant leadership model, and his part of that framework is the idea of the leader being the first among equals. So you have a group of people, a team, and the person who has the expertise or the knowledge that is needed at that moment is the person who is taking a more authoritative leadership role. But that person then steps back and someone else steps forward when that need requires that person to step forward. And I think that's part of the answer, but it's not the whole answer at all as well. So it's a very interesting dynamic that I see going on, and I think the fact that there's no simple answer to it keeps our attention and makes us more observant of what's going on, so we're actually probably better at bringing about change and innovation as a result.
Very much part of their model, and certainly their writings, is that it's leadership is difficult, it's dangerous, and it can be painful, and there could be casualties along the way. And I think we'll talk about that again next week with Marty. So,
good.
Any last thoughts you have?
Well, I would just encourage people to go get the book and read it and answer these questions for themselves and to frame their own way of describing what leadership is and find a way for them to share that with other people. I think that's part of being innovative and part of risk-taking. And when you come up with your own way of talking about what the practice of leadership is, then you are leading in doing that, and you have a way to influence people. And if you need to start a blog, then start a blog. If you need to start a podcast, start a podcast. If you want to start a book group in your business, then start a book group in your business. I think it all starts with that initiative which says, I want to make a difference, and this is how I'm going to do it. And if you were to do that as the average person, creating a shared language and being a peer consultant and supporting risk-taking and innovation wherever you are, I think you'll be leading, and you'll figure out what leadership is as a result, and you'll have something to offer to us. And the conversation will expand our own sense of what is possible and during this time of great change.
Well, excellent advice as always, and you can find that regularly on Leading Questions and regularly on Weekly Leader in the Leadership Q&A and now the Work Life Lead. So I really appreciate you joining me today. It was great doing the interview with you. I enjoyed that very much, and it was great having you today. And hopefully we'll get you on here again if we can bump Pam off occasionally.
Well, thank you. I'd look forward to that.
Okay, Ed. It was great fun. We would really love for you to join us in a leadership conversation, and we give you tons of ways to do that. There's the main blog at weeklyleader.net, where we have a team of passionate bloggers who are dying to talk to you about their favorite topic, leadership. So get over there, find a post, and engage in the conversation with one of them. We have the show blog, which is weeklyleader.net/podcast, and each show, each episode has its own post where there's tons of links and videos and things like that that we've embedded. Very useful information from each of the podcasts. So leave a comment on any one of those, too. We'd love to hear from you. We have a Google widget on the podcast blog, and it's a Google Voice widget, I should say. And all you have to do is click on it, and it'll help you leave an audio comment. So it's pretty self-explanatory. Give it a try. We'd love to hear from you. You can always send us an email at podcast@weeklyleader.net, and we will we'll find a way to get you into the show. If you attach an MP3 file of 5 meg or less, that would be excellent, because it would be great to hear some of your voices instead of just me and Pam and Ed and the other members of the team. If you are on Twitter, you can always get us there too. And Weekly Leader, believe it or not, has a Twitter ID, which is @WeeklyLeader. I'm @PeterMello, and that's PeterMello, and Pam is @PamFR. All of our podcasting partners and bloggers are listed in the show notes, links to their Twitter IDs. If you use iTunes, we would really appreciate it if you would consider rating and reviewing the podcast, because the more people who hear about it or read the reviews, favorable reviews, hopefully, more listeners we'll get. We always use PodSafe music, and our intro is Transcends by Trance Blackmon. And this week we're going to close out with a cover of a classic song by Chris Isaak called Wicked Game, and the cover is by Ruby James. So we know how valuable your time is, and we want to really thank you for investing it with us. We look forward to being with you again next week, where we'll have the second half of the interview with Marty Linsky. Thanks.
me feel this way.